At American University, President John F. Kennedy speaks to the graduating class with a proposal of a test ban treaty.
I have chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived, and that is the most important topic on earth, peace. I speak of peace because of the new face of war. Total war makes no sense in an age where great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces. It makes no sense in an age where a single nuclear weapon contains almost 10 times the explosive force delivered by all the Allied air forces in the Second World War. It makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe and to generations yet unborn. To secure these ends, high-level discussions will shortly begin in Moscow, looking towards early agreement on a comprehensive test ban treaty. To make clear our good faith and solemn convictions on this matter, I now declare that the United States does not propose to conduct nuclear tests in the atmosphere so long as other states do not do so. The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this program, we're listening to Alan Weissman talk with Francesca Rhiannon about the overpopulation crisis and how we can solve it. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Nitrogen fertilizer is derived from fossil fuels. It takes fossil fuels to fabricate it. And then when it degrades, you get nitrous oxide, which after methane is our third most potent greenhouse gas. So if we cut that out, by cutting it out, I don't mean tomorrow, but we phase out of it gradually over the next couple of two, three decades or so, we would be accompanying that with managed population growth, meaning that people would be encouraged to have just two children or fewer and would have the opportunity, you know, the contraceptives to make that decision. If they wanted to have big families, you know, one resource that we're never running out of is children who need a home, so people can adopt and have as many children as they want. That certainly solved one of the huge problems of the Chinese one-child policy back when China was still mostly rural population. They were favoring male births because you wanted those strong young farmhands and girl babies. You know, there was tremendous gender discrimination and selective abortion. But today, you know, adoption leapt in, and we see all over the United States and Europe and Canada and Australia this beautiful, sprinkling of Chinese girls in our current generation of youth. And internal adoption in China is now way up too. So yeah, there are ways to get around what we might perceive initially to be problems. This is something that we actually can do, and there's great momentum in the world for it right now. Nearly half the countries in the world are either at, near, or below replacement rate. Everywhere I went, you make contraception available, and women want to use it. You combine that with female education, and, I mean, this is a no-brainer. You know, I talked about the hopelessness of Pakistan, but one of the most hopeful stories in this book is in Pakistan, where five Pakistani businessmen having dinner one night and just complaining about what a wreck their nation was, finally decided to do something about it themselves. And the schools were so dysfunctional, they decided to start their own school system. It's a private school system, but it costs next to nothing. And they built schools in the poorest parts of rural and urban Pakistan. They insist that these schools be co-educational. 50% girls, they want boys and girls growing up alongside each other so the boys can learn to respect them. They have all-female teachers so people aren't scared about sending their daughters to school. And they don't talk about family planning in these because oftentimes they're very, very conservative populations there. But when the kids get into secondary school, they ask them what professions they might be interested in, and they pair them with mentors, professional mentors in these professions. So girls are, you know, doctors, nurses, flight attendants, school teachers. And what the girls see is that all of these role models have two children or fewer because otherwise they can't have their jobs. And that's how the message gets out. And I asked these guys, I said, but, you know, what about the Taliban? Because they have vowed to blow up all these schools if they're teaching girls. And they said, we made it clear to the Taliban from the very start. We promised them for every school of ours that they blow up, we would start five more. And today, they have over 900 schools in Pakistan, and this is still growing. It's doubled since I was there 3 years ago. So, you know, just think of the benefit. You know, think of the extra, you know, brilliance that we're going to have in our labor force with all these prepared girls. You know, a lot of economists say, what are we going to do, you know, if we have fewer babies being born and all these senior citizens that they have to support through the welfare rolls? And
yeah, so get into that. And tell us about the economy based on, I think you say that the optimal population is about 2 billion, so we got a ways to go.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what about the population was before we started using nitrogen fertilizer. There's another calculation in the book about optimum population that was done by John Holdren, who is now President Obama's science advisor. And he was just looking at carbon, projected carbon use, and he was looking at this about 15 years ago in the 1990s, but his predictions were remarkably prescient, of course. And trying to determine how much carbon dioxide quotas could we have per capita in the world if everybody had a fairly reasonable lifestyle, say a European lifestyle, not as profligate as the American lifestyle, and certainly one that Africans or South Asians might aspire to. And that figure divided out came out to be between 1.5 and 2 to 3 billion people maximum. Look, having many fewer children reduces the carbon legacy of any woman more so than anything else that she can do, the number of Priuses she's driving or compact fluorescent bulbs or whatever. If there's a calculation in the book of the tens of tons of carbon dioxide that each child represents. Now, in terms of the economy, just a couple of things about what we hear from traditional economists about the fear-mongering of, oh, we're going to have way too many old people and not enough young people, and that's why there's been a spate of books that came out not long before my book came out about why there were in danger of population crashes in the developed countries. A couple of things about that. First of all, pro-growth economists love big populations because it keeps labor cheap. They want a lot of poor people fighting each other over bad salaries, and they want to keep suppressing those wages. When we start bringing population down, workers will be fewer, and therefore they're going to be more valued, and wages will actually remain high. Second, the idea that we're going to have this bubble of all these senior citizens that we're going to have to take care of with just fewer workers, as opposed to what we have today, where, you know, children are much more of an economic burden on society than seniors, for one, because our health is better. Seniors are still they're 65. Some of them pushing 80. Second, you know, kids, unless they're farmhands, of which, you know, many fewer of us live on farms now, they cost society money. They don't really contribute very much in terms of earning power, and we need to maintain schools for them, etc. So the idea that we cannot transition gradually over the next few decades to a much more sustainable size is really, well, it's belied in my book by the chapter that I set in Japan when we talk about the economy, because Japan now has an economy, or it has a population that is actually shrinking for a couple of anomalous reasons, but it is really the pioneer nation in this. Japan's population is shrinking because after World War II, its economy was wrecked, and they started having a baby boom for the same reason that we had ours. Our soldiers went back home to their wives. But then they were starving there. So in an emergency measure in 1949, they legalized abortion. Remember, this was before birth control pills, because pregnant Japanese women were throwing themselves in front of trains. You know, women did not want to see any more babies die of hunger. So millions of them partook of the abortions. And now, as a last overgrown generation that was born before World War II, you might remember Japan started World War II because they had an overpopulation problem, so they were trying to expand into Manchuria. Anyhow, as that generation now begins to pass on, there's a much smaller baby boom generation to replace them. And they, in turn, have many fewer babies. And with the high education levels, most Japanese women who live in crowded cities are only having one kid, some two and some none. And, of course, traditional economists are terrified by this. But I traveled to see a very visionary economist named Akihiko Matsutani, who's not a radical. He's part of a major policy institute. But he sees this as an opportunity. Japan is going to have to learn to live more within its means. And that was really underscored by the fact that not long before I got there, Fukushima took care of all their, you know, nuclear power. And Japan has to discover, you know, it also lost its most fertile fruit-bearing region, too, in that disaster. So the fact that their population now is starting to drop dramatically, and by the middle of this century, they're going to be much closer towards their World War II population than today's, which is over 100 million. What he sees is going to happen is that, as I follow in this book, I follow young people who are now moving into the hinterlands because older people no longer live in these farming villages and there's land available and housing available for cheap. He says lighter industry will follow them. You don't need to have everybody in these crowded port cities so they can import all these raw materials for export, you know, heavy industries. They'll have lighter industries for more domestic use. Wages will remain high because workers will be fewer, but because demand will shrink with population, working hours will diminish. And that means that we're going to redefine prosperity as having more leisure time to enjoy more space that we'll also have. And this is really a workable idea for a future. And it's not going to be totally easy, but he said over the next few decades, as population comes down, economy will be able to adjust to a stable rate. And, you know, as Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill before him, you know, all predicted, we're not going to be having these huge violent swings in sudden profits and sudden losses in stock markets. We'll be more in sort of a perpetual bond market situation where people will be living off more secure investments. And this is something that conservatives will really like. The only reason that we have such enormous debt and deficits now is that we're constantly borrowing money into existence. Debt is what creates our money supply in an ever-expanding economy, which occasionally just collapses on us because it expands beyond reality, like the housing crisis. As we shrink down to a stable situation, to a steady-state economy, we'll be back on a cash basis. That means a balanced budget. Now, what conservative is going to argue with that?
Well, it's a great vision, and one that I very desperately hope will actually come to pass, because the alternative is just so terrifying. Alan Weissman, this is just a terrific book. I think it should be required reading for everybody. Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
It's been a pleasure, Francesca.
Jesus Christ was a man that traveled through the land, hard-working man and brave. He said to the rich, give your goods to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot has laid poor Jesus in his grave. He went to the preacher, he went to the sheriff, told them all the same, sell all of your jewelry and give it to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. When Jesus come to town, the working folks around believed what he did say. The bankers and the preachers, they nailed him on a cross, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Now the working people followed him around, sang and shouted gay. But the cops and soldiers nailed him in the air, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Well, the people held their breath when they heard about his death. Everybody wondered why. It was the landlord and the soldiers that he hired to nail Jesus Christ in the sky. This song was made in New York City of rich man's and preachers and slaves. If Jesus was to preach like he preached in Galilee, they would lay Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man and a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot has laid poor Jesus in his grave.
So tell me, family, now what do you think? Watch it all grow down the great big sea. Watch how the storm rises to the top. Don't you wanna win? It's all gonna stop. Sometimes I wonder how we do sleep. Serving the dodgy companies we keep. I'm kicking and scrounging for the very first place. Dictionary definition of a rat race. Pay off those losers we elect. Stealing from the mouths that women to feed, enslaving the very clothes upon my back. I feel the sting, but I hear no crack, no crack. I'm saying, run through the fire, run through the flame, run through the hatred, pushing through the blame, run through the hopelessness and shame. Revolution, no. Every pirate's man digging those holes, messing with something that they can't control. Just passing lands where they don't belong. All I hear is screaming the once were songs. I got my brothers, they are fighting those wars, fighting over scraps and scraping their souls. Seeing it. our eyes. Cause from this nightmare, yes, I must now wake. Open my fists, my destiny I take. People seek and dive and push around. We call them kings, but I see no crown. And tell me when you think we'll just stand up. Say enough is enough, is enough, enough. I'm saying it. Running through the fire, running through the flame, running through the
it's the hope of hopes. watching us from a distance.
What truth? That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.